Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1184, I will have two segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the ongoing genocide in Gaza. During the second segment, I will air the remarks delivered at the Gaza Resist, Gaza Remains panel at the People's Conference for Palestine. This panel brings together Palestinian speakers to discuss life in Gaza amid genocide attempts to erase it. The speakers will speak to how Gaza's doctors, nurses, aid workers, journalists, engineers, writers, and civil defense teams continue to work under fire, protect life, and uphold dignity in the midst of a U.S.-backed Israeli-led campaign of genocide. I will air the remarks of Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, a world-renowned surgeon with academic posts at Imperial College London University, Mus'ab Abu Taha, Palestinian poet and author, and Hani Al-Madhoun, co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen and senior director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the ongoing genocide in Gaza, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 720 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has killed at least 357 Palestinians and injured at least 1,500 between September 17th and September 24th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. Most of the attacks are still concentrated in Gaza City, where Israel has been bombing high-rise residential towers, hospitals, refugee camps, and tent shelters for weeks as its ground forces advance. Reporter Mohammed Kita recorded this clip of an Israeli tank on a road in Gaza City on Tuesday. After a few moments of filming, the tank's gun rotates toward the reporter. Israel continues to use remote-controlled vehicles to destroy entire residential buildings across the city. Photojournalist Ahmed Al-Sawafiri recorded such an attack on September 20th. The UN Human Rights Office says that between September 19th and 20th, there were at least 18 recorded attacks on residential buildings in Gaza City, with dozens killed and more remaining buried under the rubble. One of the deadliest attacks, the Human Rights Office says, was a strike on September 20th on three inhabited residential buildings on a single block in the Sabra neighborhood in southern Gaza City. The Israeli attack killed at least 20 members of the Dagmash family, including 12 children, with dozens reported missing under the rubble. This came just a day after another residential building housing other members of the Dagmash family in the same area had been struck, killing 8 family members, including at least 4 girls. Faris Afanna, the director of emergency and medical services in Gaza, told reporter Mohammed Abu Salama that ambulance and rescue crews worked nonstop to recover bodies from under the rubble after the September 20th attacks. Afanna said that emergency workers, quote, continue to provide the service despite the danger. The next day, relatives searched local morgues for the remains of their loved ones, while dozens more remained trapped under the concrete. Journalist Saeed Hezbollah filmed an injured young man breaking down after losing his uncle, his cousins, and all of his relatives in the attack. Sitting on the bed of a truck loaded with bodies of his relatives wrapped in blankets, he says, quote, "Look what they did to us, so that the world will see what they're doing to us. Look, martyrs, martyrs." Israel continued to attack the Beach refugee camp in western Gaza City this week. Reporter Hussein Kersoa filmed a distraught father searching for his children buried under the rubble on September 23rd after an airstrike on homes in the camp. He says, quote, "I can't hear you, children," calling over and over again for Salma and Saeed. Shouting through tears and pounding on rubble with a hammer, he calls out to Saeed, saying, "Didn't I tell you to take care of your sister? Didn't I tell you to take care of your sister, my son?" before collapsing in agony.
Salma! Salma! Salma, Yaba! Saeed! 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 Yaba! 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 Saeed! Saeed! Yaba! Saeed!
On Wednesday, September 24th, Israel bombed a residential building where mutual aid workers with the Samir Project organized food for distribution in northern Gaza. A fire quickly spread inside the building. You can hear children screaming as they're being pulled out by people nearby. Rescue workers say that they searched for people buried in the rubble and retrieved a number of bodies. The Samir Project stated, quote, "As food packages were being organized for distribution, the occupation bombed a residential building, leveling the area around where our team was working. Nearly 500,000 people remain in the north of Gaza, whether because they refuse to leave their land or because they are unable to find costly transport south. Thousands and thousands of families still need food, still need water, still need our help as they are being bombed without mercy." And on Tuesday, civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal captured this wrenching moment when a small boy carried the body of his four-year-old cousin, Zain, wrapped in a shroud to a cemetery. Bassal says that Zain was killed in an airstrike that claimed the lives of 33 people. The boy, accompanied by his father, kisses the shroud and says, "May God have mercy on you, my beloved Zain. You and I used to play together, my darling Zain. We used to play together every day. Send my greetings to your sister and to your father and siblings." The UN Human Rights Office said that these relentless attacks, quote, "in addition to the steady advance of the Israeli ground forces toward western Gaza City, demolishing residential buildings under its control on the way, appear to have resulted in renewed waves of mass forced displacement to the south of Gaza, where there is no space, infrastructure, or basic necessities to support the influx of internally displaced persons, and where the Israeli military continues to strike shelters, the UN said. Israel's sharp increase in the number of civilians being slaughtered in Gaza City, the UN Human Rights Office added, seem intended to inflict terror on the Palestinian population of Gaza City, forcing tens of thousands to flee. Between September 17th and September 20th, nearly 82,000 Palestinians were displaced from northern to southern Gaza. Photojournalist Moaz Hosni filmed families crammed onto trucks, as he says, quote, united not by a road or a destination, but by the inability to afford the journey, like a temporary arc of collective survival. On September 20th, our contributor Asim Annabi, the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, wrote on social media that, quote, my mind cannot digest the idea of losing Gaza. My brain is incapable of processing the meaning of such a loss. I can't even understand the word itself. I can't engage with it, and I can't place it within any logical context. I might be able to understand and process the loss of anything else, to frame it in a way that time could help me cope with. But losing Gaza? No way. There's no logic in it. None at all. Israel continues to bomb hospitals and the areas surrounding them. On September 22nd, the Israeli army struck the Palestinian Medical Relief Society's building in Gaza City, sending an enormous plume of smoke into the sky. Medical Aid for Palestinians, MAP, a British charity that works with the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, stated, quote, on September 22nd, an Israeli military airstrike destroyed Al-Samar Clinic, which had been providing healthcare services since 2006. The clinic has been reduced to rubble and its services shut down. The clinic was a cornerstone of community health and provided vital primary health care, mental health support, cancer care, blood donation, physiotherapy, and women's services, MAP stated. 45 staff members, including cardiologists and nutritionists, have lost their place of work and their patients have been left without care. Staff, quote, were given just 10 minutes to evacuate before the clinic was struck. The attack has left the clinic completely destroyed and unusable, including its laboratories and its assistive devices center. In the past 3 weeks alone, the Medical Relief Society reports that three of their clinics across Gaza have been targeted in Israeli military attacks. Two have been completely destroyed, and one clinic has been partially damaged. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reported also on September 22nd that after bombing Al-Rantisi Pediatric Hospital last week, it is now completely out of service due to the Israeli army continuing to target the hospital's surroundings. Along with the only children's hospital, the last remaining clinic providing ophthalmological services in Gaza is also closed, the ministry said, as there are no safe roads to either facilities that will allow patients to reach them. Australian doctor Nada Abu Al-Rob, who is working at various Gaza hospitals, described the state of the accelerating medical catastrophe for patients and doctors, especially as mass casualty events are continuous. She says that in addition to the slaughter by airstrikes and tanks, every few hours children arrive at the hospitals malnourished and suffering from infections, leading to cardiac arrests.
We have Mohammed Hamdan here. We lost his sister yesterday, Farah Hamdan. And since it was day one for me, and since arrival, we met a lot of other kids who had the same problem. So they all arrived malnourished. Mohammed is better today. He could at least walk. Yesterday, we were so busy looking after him. There was no time to take pictures and photos and videos in the middle of disaster. His legs couldn't hold him because how malnourished he is. Adi Amr Hamdan, Mohammed. Ashra. He's 10 years old, but he definitely looks younger than 10 years old. His sister was 15. She looked 10 or 7 even. On top of the malnourishment, most of the people here are now intoxicated by the dirty water. So the water here is not good for human use. Even as doctors now, we all have gastritis. And with the poor kids, they can't tolerate as much as we do. On top of their malnutrition, once they have diarrhea, they all run into severe hypokalemia. So we're now watching kids that having a cardiac arrest. Every few hours, we have a kid with a cardiac arrest.
Dr. Nada Abu El-Rub. And doctors are still being targeted. On September 20th, Israel bombed the home of Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital, who was abducted by Israeli forces in November 2023 and detained and tortured for 7 months. He says he left his home in the Beach refugee camp to go to work at Al-Shifa, and the bodies of 6 of his relatives arrived while he was on duty. Reporter Nahed Hajjaj filmed Dr. Abu Salmiya mourning over the bodies of his brother, 2 nephews, his nephew's wife, and 2 of their children. Turning quickly to the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers backed by Israeli soldiers shot and killed 20-year-old Saeed Murad Nassan on Tuesday in the village of Al-Mugayr near Ramallah. On Wednesday, Israeli settlers then attacked the funeral of the young man, firing live ammunition at the mourners, Wafa News Agency reported. Meanwhile, Israel closed the Allenby Bridge crossing between the West Bank and Jordan indefinitely, just 3 days after reopening it following a shooting by a Jordanian national that killed 2 Israeli soldiers. The crossing in the Jordan Valley, known as Karama on the Palestinian side, is the only crossing point between Jordan and the West Bank. Most of the West Bank's 3.3 million residents depend on the bridge for travel abroad. This week, our contributor Buthaina Hamdan, who is based in Ramallah, wrote in her feature article that as the genocide continues in Gaza, quote, we are living under a slow genocide in the West Bank, with Israel's annexation of more land, daily killings at the hands of settlers and soldiers, and constant financial strain. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Brown-Eyed Girl, Men Playing Chess Massacred on My Street by Ahmed Abu Shawish, writing from Gaza. Ahmed writes about an initiative for children that he and his family started in 2024, where they used their solar panels to power a screen in the backyard of their house and display cartoons for the displaced neighboring children. Eventually, with some funding, Ahmed says that his family expanded their activities to include psychological support for the children through art and play therapy. One of those children, Ahmed says, was a 5-year-old girl named Siham Al-Ashi. Quote, Soso was the pet name I had given her as she would always run toward me, her arms wide open, ready to fold me into a hug. On November 10th, 2024, at around 1:35 p.m., I stepped outside my home. Children were completely absorbed in their games, and Soso was there, hopping between chalked squares. A few meters away, Abu Hadi, Abu Nahed, and Abu Ahmed huddled around the chessboard. Come and see how I'm finally going to beat Abu Ahmed, Abu Hadi called me with a voice full of playful confidence. I smiled and was genuinely curious as he had never won a single game before. But something made me hesitate, some kind of a providence. For the first time, I didn't join them and went back inside. I sat down, scrolling through my phone for a few minutes. My curiosity tugged at me more to see if Abu Hadi would really manage to defeat Abu Ahmed. I got up at 1:45 p.m. and opened the front door. I headed toward the garden door to open it and go out to the by street. But I felt as if everything collapsed. An explosion tore through the street and hurled me back. A storm of fragments and dust engulfed me, and my eardrums felt as if they had been perforated by the piercing sound. Chunks of flesh clung to my face and shirt. Blood spattered across our front door. I froze. My arms were trembling, my legs numb. I couldn't move for a moment. The world went silent, except for the ringing in my ears and the heaviness crushing my chest. With faltering steps, I tried to open the garden door, but it didn't budge as it had been twisted and shattered by the blast. I sprinted back inside the house, turned to the door facing the main street, then stepped outside and headed toward the by street where we used to gather every day. The scene was ineffable, horrifying beyond anything words could describe. 4 or 5 bodies lay motionless on the ground right in front of our house. I couldn't move forward, my knees locked, my voice cracked. Oh God, was all I could cry out. Dust was all around. I took a few more steps, and that's when I saw a little girl lying on the ground with part of her brain exposed from her head. She was so-so. I bent down and checked her chest, feeling for her heartbeat with shaky hands. She was still breathing, her pulse faint. Some people screamed around me, "Leave her, cover the body." I couldn't. All I was thinking about was saving so-so. I picked her up in my arms and hurried a few steps toward the main street, desperate to find any transportation to take her to the hospital. Just then, 2 people with a motorcycle stopped, took so-so and rushed her to Al Auda Hospital in Nuseirat. I returned to the site of the incident. The dust had settled, and I saw the full picture of the street. It transformed into something I still cannot name. Beheaded and torn bodies were scattered around. I couldn't recognize a single face, not even one. Then I saw a body, wearing a navy blue t-shirt I knew very well. It was mine. Only then did I realize it was my close friend Hisham's body. He had been killed alongside Abu Hadi and Abu Ahmed. So-so went into clinical death and passed away 2 days later on November 12th. The smell of death in Gaza became familiar, almost routine. The street that was once full of life now turned into a ghost street. That airstrike didn't kill me, but it destroyed something inside. It wiped out all the vibes that filled the place. From that moment on, I started avoiding walking through that road, not out of fear, but because I don't want to relive that terrible scene again. It is a mental wound that I will carry for the rest of my life. A few moments separated me from death, but maybe God chose me to live and tell the story of my friends and neighbors. Those are excerpts from Brown-Eyed Girl, Men Playing Chess Massacred on My Street by Ahmad Abu Shawish, a journalist and activist in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Today, we'll focus on a general strike by workers and union members across Italy on Monday, who shut down the country to demand an end to Israel's genocide. The Associated Press stated that Italy's grassroots unions, which represent hundreds of thousands of people ranging from school teachers to metal workers, called for a 24-hour general strike in both public and private sectors, including public transportation, trains, schools, and ports. Roads and highways were also shut down. 10,000 people blocked the main highway between Florence and Bologna alone. The transit of goods was slowed or partially blocked by workers' sit-ins and rallies in Italy's main ports of Genova and Livorno. More than 20,000 people gathered in front of Rome's central station to protest the genocide. Unions and student organizations denounced, quote, the inertia of the Italian and EU governments, the AP reported. Walter Montagnoli, the national secretary of the CUB union, said at the protest in Milan, quote, if we don't block what Israel is doing, if we don't block trade, the distribution of weapons and everything else with Israel, we will not ever achieve anything. The Italian news site Genova 24 compiled clips of some of the protests. Students declared, "We are all anti-Zionists," and marched in the streets of Genova.
Forte, forte!
Siamo tutti anti-Zionisti!
Forte!
Siamo tutti anti-Zionisti!
Ancora, ancora!
Siamo tutti!
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On August 29th through the 31st, 2025, the second annual People's Conference for Palestine was held in Detroit, Michigan, attended by over 4,600 people, with thousands more joining them online. The conference slogan was, "Gaza is the compass." There were many great speakers covering critical and timely topics, and I'm going to share during this episode of Arab Voices the remarks delivered at the Gaza Resist, Gaza Remains panel. This panel brings together Palestinian speakers to discuss life in Gaza amid genocidal attempts to erase it. The speakers will speak on how Gaza's doctors, nurses, aid workers, journalists, engineers, writers, and civil defense teams continue to work under fire, protect life, and uphold dignity in the midst of a U.S.-backed Israeli-led campaign of genocide. I will air the remarks of Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, a world-renowned surgeon with academic posts at Imperial College London University, Mus'ab Abu Toha, a Palestinian poet and author, and Hani Al-Madhoun, co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen and senior director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Ibtihal Maali, organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement, who was the moderator for this panel.
I'm really honored to be here today and to be your moderator today for this incredible panel. Welcome to our first plenary of the day, Gaza Resists, Gaza Remains. In the last 2 years, we've seen a thoroughly planned and deliberate attack on Gaza in what can only be described as a campaign of annihilation and total destruction of Palestinian people, land, life, and future. Israel's scorched earth policy has decimated the very infrastructure that is meant to sustain any form of life. We've seen entire areas reduced to rubble, targeted assassinations, total destruction of hospitals and schools, and we've also seen the targeted use of engineered famine and starvation to carry out this barbaric genocide. The theme of this panel grounds us in the material conditions and reality on the ground. Our panelists and their experiences will shed insight into what our duty to Gaza's people is in this moment, and how we can both support Gaza-based initiatives while fighting to bring those responsible for the genocide to justice. I'm honored to be joined by our guest speakers today. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta. Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta is a British-Palestinian plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He completed his medical education at the University of Glasgow in the UK and his postgraduate residency training in London. He later underwent 3 fellowships, pediatric craniofacial surgery at Great Ormond Street Hospital for sick kids, cleft surgery at GOS, and a further fellowship in trauma reconstruction at the Royal London Hospital. In 2011, he was recruited by the American University of Beirut Medical Center. In 2012, he became head of the Division of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at the AUBMC, clinical lead of its pediatric war injuries program and war injuries multidisciplinary clinic. In 2015, co-founded and became director of the Conflict Medicine Program at Global Health Institute at the American University of Beirut. He returned to the UK in 2020 and continues in plastic and reconstructive surgery in the private sector. He is an honorary senior clinical lecturer at the Center for Blast Injury Studies at Imperial College, University of London, and visiting senior lecturer at the Conflict and Health Research Group at King's College, London University. He's clinical lead for the Operational Trauma Initiative at the World Health Organization's EMRO office and serves on the board of directors of INARA, a charity dedicated to providing reconstructive surgery to war-injured children in the Middle East, and board of trustees of the UK-based Medical Aid for Palestinians. He serves on the UK's National Institute of Health Research International Funding Committee. He has published extensively on the health consequences of prolonged conflict and on war injuries, including a medical textbook, Reconstructing the War-Injured Patient and Treating the War-Injured Child. He has worked as a war surgeon in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, South Lebanon, and during the four wars in the Gaza Strip. On the 9th of October, 2023, he entered the Gaza Strip and worked in a Shifa hospital and then Al Ahli Baptist Hospital for 43 days during the current genocide. Evidence he provided was part of the South African submission to the International Court of Justice and in the ICC arrest warrants. In April 2024, he was elected Lord Rector of the University of Glasgow and was awarded an honorary doctorate from the American University of Beirut, where he is currently Professor of Conflict Medicine. His work was featured by numerous newspapers and media outlets, notably Le Monde, The Independent, Telegraph, BBC, and CNN. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Ghassan. We are also joined in person by Mus'ab Abu Toha. Mus'ab is a Palestinian poet and writer from Gaza. His first collection of poetry, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry and won a Palestine Book Award, an American Book Award, and the Wolcott Poetry Prize. Abu Toha is also the founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, whose two branches Israel destroyed in 2024. He won the 2025 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary and a 2024 Overseas Press Club Award for his Letter from Gaza columns for The New Yorker. His new book, Forest of Noise, was named a New York Times notable book and was longlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize. Also joining us in person is Hani Al-Madhoun. Hani is the co-founder of the Gaza Soup Kitchen, a grassroots effort that provides daily hot meals. A grassroots effort that provides daily hot meals and direct assistance to families in Gaza, including his own. Despite serving as senior director of philanthropy at UNRWA USA, Hani felt compelled to take direct action as famine spread. Coordinating from Washington, D.C., he fundraises and advocates internationally while his family and community on the ground cook and distribute food under bombardment. His work blends personal loss with humanitarian action, turning grief into sustenance for thousands of Palestinians. Welcome, and I'm looking forward to our discussion. Our first question is going to be directed to Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta. Dr. Ghassan, you've spoken and written extensively on Israel's barbaric assault on hospitals and the health sector as one that's definitive of its assault on life in Gaza. Can you speak about the current state of medicine and healthcare in Gaza? What is Israel's political goal behind attacking hospitals, placing a siege, and creating starvation?
First of all, thank you very much for this invitation. I'm sorry I can't be with you. Ever since I served in Gaza during the marches of return and the move by the American administration of its embassy to Jerusalem, I, despite having a British passport, was banned from visiting the United States. So we'll have to do with this Zoom. So it was very clear from the very beginning of this genocide that Israel had really reinvented the idea of scorched earth policy to one which deals with a world where the majority of the population doesn't live in rural areas and therefore need to be napalmed and Agent Oranged, but lives in an urban environment. The health structures, the health system, needs not to just to be attacked, but to dismantle. And by that, I mean, we started on the 12th of October with phone calls to every medical director of every hospital in Gaza, ordering them to evacuate these hospitals. Otherwise, they would bear the responsibility for the imminent attacks. And this was of October 2023. And on the 7th of October, Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital, where an Israeli missile was fired into the forecourt of the hospital, killing 483 civilians. And then the systematic destruction that followed, you know, the three pediatric hospitals in the north, then the first siege of Shifa, and so on and so forth, until now we're left with three partially functioning hospitals out of 39. And this is despite the fact that every time the Israelis have destroyed a hospital, our Palestinian colleagues have reopened it. The Indonesian hospital, which is in Jabalia, was fixed three times by our colleagues and reopened. Al-Awda Hospital in Jabalia camp kept working until only a month ago, until it was forced to close, despite being shelled, despite having snipers fire into it, despite losing three of its doctors in an Israeli missile attack, despite the arrest of its medical director, Dr. Ahmed Mahanna. So that component is the destruction of buildings. We then have the systematic murder of a whole generation of health workers. So now over 1,600 have been killed. The most recent is the head of pediatrics at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. But also from early October, we were working in Shifa, and every day one of our colleagues would be killed within half an hour of going home to their house. It was first Dr. Midhat Saydam, a plastic surgeon working with us at the Burns unit, and then Dr. Hammam Al-Loh. And now we have a horrendous number. We have whole specialties that have been completely wiped out. You then, having taken out the human element, you create the conditions for death. You weaponize water and sewage by also from the very beginning, from October 23, bombing the water desalination plants in Gaza and the sewage treatment plants in Gaza, and then systematically destroy the water and sewage infrastructure so that we have rare diseases on epidemic levels, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a virus. We have over 85 cases in Gaza. We have a rate of polio to Gaza. Also to increase the rate of genocidal killing. And then at the end, to weaponize people's bodies against themselves. The famine that Israel has manufactured means that the colleagues now report that patients are not surviving surgeries that they should be surviving, because when they're injured, they're too malnourished to withstand the trauma or to heal the wound after the surgery. And the surgeons and the doctors and the nurses are too malnourished to be able to finish these shifts to work to help these people. And so what Israel has done is really created a machinery of genocide, where everything is weaponized, from the water to the sewage, to the buildings, to every little thing, so that unlike what the published numbers are, 65,000 traumatic deaths that have registered, the real number is most likely closer to 400,000. More than 12 to 50% of Gaza's population, because Israel was able to weaponize life itself as part of its genocidal project.
As the IDF continuously targets writers, thinkers, and cultural institutions, what has this war done to education and cultural life, and what new forms have they taken since the start of the war?
It is a great honor to be in this room with every one of you. It is another great honor to be in a room that is named after Anas al-Sharif. May God, may Allah bless his soul. And I pray for the safety and well-being of our fighters, the Palestinian journalists who have been uncovering and exposing the Israeli genocide when we know that many Western journalists are trying to discredit them by citing what Israel is saying about them. So let's pray for the Palestinian journalists, the fighters on the ground who have been exposing Israel and showing its true face, the face that we as Palestinians who have been living in Palestine have been seeing for over 77 years, not only 70, but 77, over 77 years. I don't think that we can separate Israel's attacks on hospitals in Gaza from Israel's attacks on universities, on schools, on pharmacies, on kindergartens, or even Israel's attacks on fishermen in the sea, and even Israel's attacks on the waves of the sea. Because Israel wants to annihilate everything that is Palestinian, even the stones that Palestinian children use to play with. So that's a very important point to raise. As to my remarks, it's been the Israeli occupation's tactic to murder, imprison, and intimidate Palestinian artists and writers. Ghassan Kanafani, who was living in exile after the occupation of Palestine in 1948, was assassinated in Beirut in July 1972, at the age of 36. My dear friend Rifat Al-Ar'il, who was born and lived in Gaza, occupied Palestine, was killed in December 2023, at the age of 44. Kanafani was killed alongside his niece, Lamis, while Al-Ar'il was killed along with his two siblings and four nephews. And 4 months later, Rifat's eldest daughter, Shayma. And by the way, Shayma was the you in his poem, If I Must Die, because Rifat wrote that poem in 2011. So when he said, if I must die, you must live to tell my story, the you in that poem was Shayma, and Shayma was killed 4 months after Rifat. So we all should think that the you in this poem is every one of us who should live to tell the story of Rifat, of Shayma, of Abdurrahman, of Anas, of every single Palestinian, whose voice, whose life has been taken by Israel, and whose photos are not shown on Western mainstream media. From the 5 months imprisonment of Palestinian poet Darin Tattur for reading a poem of hers, in prison of Palestinian novelist Walid Daqqa, who was the longest serving Palestinian prisoner in Israel, in Israeli jails, having spent 38 years in prison, Israel continues to embody the cancerous nature of occupation. In 2021, Walid Daqqa was diagnosed with cancer, prompting calls for his release upon completion of his original sentence in 2023, but he had received a further 2 year in sentence in 2018 for smuggling a mobile phone to prisoner. On January 17th, 2024, the Israeli military detonated 315 mines to destroy the Gaza Strip's last standing university, Al-Isra University in southern Gaza. According to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, just 6 months into the Israeli genocide, more than 5,479 students, 261 teachers, and 95 university professors have been killed in Gaza. And over 7,819 students and 756 teachers have been injured. At least 60% of educational facilities, including 13 public libraries, have been damaged or destroyed. And at least 625,000 students had no access to education until today. Another 195 heritage sites, 227 mosques, and the three churches have been, now it's four churches, have been damaged or destroyed, including the central archives of Gaza, containing 150 years of history. Despite the challenges, teachers and volunteers can be found opening tents, just like other volunteers are trying to feed people. There are other teachers and volunteers who have been trying to educate the young generation in Gaza, the future of Palestine, in tents in dangerous areas. For example, my wife's sister, Jawahar, has been trying to conduct fun and educational activities for the children in her school shelter in Beit Lahia, which they had to evacuate. She only paused these activities when there were airstrikes near the school or when armed Israeli quadcopters issued warnings or made terrifying sounds. My cousin Hassan, who is a trainer and development specialist, established a large tent in Gaza City that attracted over 2,700 children and adults. My friend Nabil from Deir al-Balah in southern Gaza posted on his Facebook shortly after the failed ceasefire agreement was announced that he was seeking a language tutor for his 11-year-old child. Education in Palestine is a source of pride and strength for its people. The catastrophe of 1948 made 80% of the population in Palestine displaced, most of them until today. The Palestinian people have witnessed the loss of 85% of their land. This percentage has increased due to the Israeli ongoing occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, despite the lack of institutional stability afforded to them through Israeli occupation and the continued destruction of schools and universities in Gaza. Palestinians maintain a national literacy rate of 97.7%. It is because education remains one of the most essential and powerful ways to resist occupation. It is how Palestinians hold on to their homeland, and it is how they invite others to visualize it based on our own experiences and also imagine it the way we hope to find it. The two branches of the Edward Said Public Library that I established in 2017 and 2019 were destroyed. It took each package of books many weeks to arrive in Gaza before I placed each book on the shelves. But just in a few seconds, everything was gone, and even including the library that I created in my own house, many of them signed by American authors. Now, my hope that I will rebuild the two libraries and more with the help of my friends all over the world, just like I did 8 years ago, remains. But unfortunately, one of the libraries of the Edward Said libraries in Gaza, one of the librarians at the Edward Said Public Library in Gaza was killed in December 2023 along with her whole family, Dua al-Masri. I know that Dua's hope is that we open the libraries to make the children less traumatized. We resist by continually hoping, working, and inviting others to join our fight for freedom. Freedom is collective and hope is an action. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is to Hani. Hani, you have worked for decades in humanitarian aid in Gaza through organizations like UNRWA and through more grassroots initiatives like the Gaza Soup Kitchen. Since the siege and starvation campaign have intensified, we're seeing a concentrated attack on all aid efforts, which are now being replaced with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Can you speak, boo? Can you speak to the impact the GHF has had on aid distribution at large? What is the reality on the ground right now for those risking their lives to provide aid and for those who are in a critical state of needing this aid?
All right, thanks everyone. Being under the spotlight makes me nervous usually. When I am under the spotlight, I've been asked questions by people with badges. All right, I tried. Michigan is a tough crowd. In Chicago, people love this joke, FYI. I just want to give you a quick update. UNRWA remains in Gaza. They are operational, underground. Thank you. They are responding, though aid is not being allowed in there, but every day UNRWA doctors see about 15,000 patients. That's the size of Madison Square Garden of people who are not feeling well, and UNRWA is responding to that need. So please make sure people know that UNRWA remains at the ground. The best thing the Zionist would love for you is to think it's not responding and UNRWA is dead. It is struggling, but they remain in Gaza. The staff are in Gaza. We started the Gaza Soup Kitchen when this genocide began, and I'm here in my Gaza Soup Kitchen capacity and not UNRWA capacity, because I want to get real with you, and you know, when these clips show up in these sites, I want that to be clear. We started because we were tired of, you know, a lot of these entities who were not or being stopped from delivering food to the north, and our own family was struggling. We did it because my neighbors were like, Hani, please, we need to eat for the first 2 months. Every single grain and every single pasta in Gaza was gone. And what we did was try to do from what's available. Then Chef Mahmoud, Allah yarhamu, he started cooking for the community, foraging. Khubbeza, common mallow, persillin, and it fed the community for 2 months. There was some, especially in an area in Beit Lahia called Al-Atatra, there was some potatoes. He bought 800 kilos one time. He bought zucchinis, carrots, anything he can find. These zucchinis were supposed to be small and, you know, for kusa mahshi, but they were the size of a pumpkin because nobody dared to go pick him up from the plants. So we cooked for the community. You couldn't really do kusa mahshi from those gigantic ones. So we keep the community alive and we keep doing this. And unfortunately, you know, because we've done a lot of work, the moment the Israelis noticed our work when we were helping, and the good doctor will know, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya at the Kamala Adwan Hospital, he was basically in speed dial calling my brother, Chef Mahmoud, come deliver food for the community. And we would. We would come up when the Israelis did not have accelerant in one of the last invasions through Kamala Adwan. They collected, and it was November, they collected all the blankets and they used those to set up the fire in the second floor. So that's, and everybody was without a blanket. Chef Mahmoud showed up the next day with blankets and rice and diapers and a lot of these things. And a few days later, they will kill Chef Mahmoud because of what he did for the community. They sent a drone, waited for him outside, and they killed him. Yeah. Thank you. They thought that we will stop working, but we did not. Every single family member of ours, every single crew, they said, no, people will still starve after Chef Mahmoud, and they kept cooking for the community. This is not a slogan. I'm tired of slogans. I'm tired of empty speeches. We want it to make sure, oh, thank you. We want to make sure our family have food and our neighbors are taken care of. And to the best of our ability, when the famine was in June and July, we, the family, and this is sad, our family was the only operation that remained without closing their door. Shame on the world central kitchen for closing in Gaza, leaving the community. And Chef Jose Andres, whatever his name is, he's, yes, he says he's very political in Russia, Ukraine. He has no sympathy for the Russians. But when it comes to Israel, can we all get along? He never talks about our suffering. He thinks it's a misfortune. Oh yeah, he white watches this. And his former staff write me in the DM, tell me a lot of these horrors. So this is the precursor for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And remember, a lot of their staff were killed, and the best they could do is ask for an investigating, and they never pushed for one. They never cared for facts. They just did not want to upset Israel. And I'm responsible for those words. So now, is Anthony here? Anthony, the guy who set GHF on fire. I saw him last night. The former security contractors who really spoke truth. Are you here, Anthony? Can we give him a shout out? If you see him, make sure to thank him. He spoke the truth and he made a big impact about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. What I've learned from Anthony yesterday, that this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation hires people who are from motorcycle club called the Infidels Motorcycle Club. They think the Crusade War is still alive. They all have Crusade tattoos, and these are the kind of undereducated, overgrown juvenile they send to Gaza right now. These people pepper spray the Palestinians. They're ready to see Palestinians dead. Not all of them are like that, but the majority of them, many of them, in fact, the founder of the company that ships these contractors to Gaza cannot leave the state of North Carolina because he has some charges against him. That's the kind of morally shady characters that run this operation in Gaza. Do not believe anything about these guys. They're not being funded by any entity or government. There is an Israeli-American tech guy who's bankrolling this initiative. And also, the U.S. government is defending them because they want to undermine UNRWA. And guess what? They are building a concentration camp inside middle area now in Gaza, where they're going to have people live there and they're going to distribute food. That's why we need your advocacy. We talk too much, we care too much about this, but I don't see the time thing, but stop me when I finish. But I just want to let you know a couple of things. One, please be invested in the political process in this country. Do not resign from it. It's disgusting, I know, but we have to be in the room. Some of these politicians are in sale. Our community should have our members of Congress that we can call. Some of them, you can, with a $50,000 contribution, they will go to a trip to Gaza. Some of these people, you know, they spend the summer in Tel Aviv and they claim to represent America and they love the U.S., but the first call comes from Bibi Netanyahu, the answer. Yes. Two, please, please, please run for office. As much as you can, we need you to run for office and try. You know, we're here, we're Congresswoman Rashida, she's amazing. We need 10 more, inshallah. And then also support initiatives like the IMEU, like this group, because we also need that power. We need the Institute for Middle East Understanding, the Rethink Media, because they tell our stories. So also invest in those institutions. Support, yes, support the Gaza Soup Kitchen. And by the way, we are incorporated in Michigan. The Gaza Soup Kitchen was incorporated in Michigan. For the simple fact, I live in Virginia, and at the time, the government of Virginia was going after Palestinian charities, and I said, you know, we should go to Michigan, because that's where our people are, and there's a lot of people who make sense here. So we're based here. Continue to speak out, share as much as you can about this, and please center the voices of Gaza. Maybe Mus'ab doesn't want you to know this now, but Mus'ab and I are fighting with Georgetown. What did Georgetown do?
Yeah, they reached out.
So Georgetown did a conference about Gaza. They had amazing speakers we love and respect. And guess what? Zero person from Gaza, zero person with a family in Gaza. Yes. So please remember, we're all proud of the speakers, but remember we need people who are actually in the front line fighting this and paying the price. With that, thank you.
What you just heard were some of the remarks delivered at the Gaza Resist, Gaza Remains panel held during the second annual People's Conference for Palestine that took place in Detroit, Michigan at the end of August 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.